love, sex, and economics. Now, you probably thought you'd never hear those three words together in a sentence, but it turns out that sex and love have a lot to do with economics, according to Marina Adshade. She is an economist and teaches at the University of British Columbia. She also has a book and blog called Dollars and Sex. She joins us now from Vancouver, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hello.
So dishy. People must love talking to you about your work. Am I right?
You know, it's interesting. When I tell people that I'm an economist and I specialize in economics and love, people's first instinct is to say, those things don't belong together at all.
You say, yes, actually, they do, and I'll show you the supply and demand curve.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it doesn't take very long to convince people that it's true. And in fact, if people think about it a little bit themselves, people often come back and go, but I was thinking recently about this. And so, you know, I think that it's easy to tie these things together.
How did you come to this? Surely you could have spent your entire career focused on supply management in the dairy industry.
Well, you know, it's funny because I came to this not as a research topic. I came through this through teaching. 10 years ago, I was looking for new ways to teach courses that made them more interesting to students, you know, encourage students to take the material and apply it to their own lives. And I thought, well, why not do a course in sex and love? This is something that actually really interests students. So I started offering a course, and that's really what's brought me down this, you know, 10-year journey of writing and speaking about this topic.
What are some areas in which economics really does apply?
Well, you know, I'm an economist. I'm hard-pressed to think of any areas in which economics doesn't apply. You know, I think that it applies to every area of our lives. It applies to, you know, the way that we look for new relationships, the way that we organize our relationships. It's having big impacts on, you know, the rate at which people get married and how they choose to have their children and whether or not they stay married. So it really affects every area of our lives. In fact, I'm doing some reading today on teen pregnancy. Teen pregnancy rates have fallen dramatically in the last 10 years. And the main reason is economics.
Hmm. Now, biologists can point to attributes of fertility that affect attractiveness, like, you know, height and weight and, you know, other fertility characteristics. What matters in the personal finance realm? So are you sizing someone up based on their, you know, their watch and the leather of their shoes to see if they're going to be able to provide for your family?
So the economic story does account for the fact that people look for people based on other characteristics other than finance. You know, we're operating out on a market. We tend to match with people who are similar to us in terms of attractiveness and height and other attributes beyond finance. But, of course, finance matters, and it matters way more than it did in the past. If you went back 30, 40, 50 years ago, people didn't really match that closely on terms of their income or their wealth levels. You know, it wasn't uncommon for somebody who, you know, a man, for example, who, you know, has an advanced degree or is a lawyer or a doctor to marry somebody who didn't finish high school. That just doesn't happen anymore. So really, it's becoming more and more about finances as time goes by, and I don't see any reason why that would change. But it's not necessarily an issue of people are just, like, scouting out other people based on their wealth. It comes down to the way that we kind of sort and match with each other. We tend to end up with people who are similar to ourselves. Finance is one of those things that people match on.
What do you learn when you layer in the online dating culture? Because those apps are aesthetic first. You're swiping left or swiping right based on your view of the hotness of the photo in front of you. I guess on date two or three, you might layer in the university degree or the, you know, salary band.
So I don't think, you know, it's funny because I don't think it is on date two and three. And if you're on a dating app like Tinder, it gives you very little information. But the one thing it does is give you university. Its name, university, and where you work are the three main pieces of information you get about the person, and then the picture that shows you how hot they are.
Right.
And so really upfront, and people aren't waiting till their second and third dates for that. They're figuring that out probably before they even arrange to meet with somebody.
One of the phrases you used in another interview that I thought was really interesting is marriage is about valuing consumption. Mm-hmm. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, that sounds so unromantic. And I know that it sounds unromantic, but it's actually, it's the opposite of that. It is actually really speaks to how much more relationships are about romance now than they were in the past. You know, in the past, people got together because, you know, it was a way of maximizing production. You know, women specialized in the home, men specialized in working in the workforce, and people had lots of children and a house. And so really they were, marriage was about production, but marriage isn't about production anymore. And it really hasn't been. This has been declining for probably 100 years. But now marriage is way more about consumption. And, you know, it consumption in the sense of, like, you know, enjoying your life together with another person. You know, I always say to people, you can imagine going to Italy. You could go by yourself. That would be fine. You'd still have a good time. But if you went with somebody else, particularly somebody that you're in a loving relationship with, that just increases the value of that trip. And so really that's what I mean by consumption there.
Economists have extraordinary mastery over data in addition to all the other skills that economists bring. What are the rich data sources that we're able to tap into in today's day and age that we wouldn't have been able to tap into even 10 or 20 years ago?
Well, thank you for that, first of all. We do love data and we love facts, you know, and we love being able to measure things. And if we can't measure things, we really don't want to talk about them. And there is so much more data now. You know, there's, you know, online dating's been around for a while. You probably know that. It's been around for 25 years now. And, you know, right from the onset, online dating sites were willing to share their data with researchers. Now, many of the online dating sites have their own services, have their own economists who work for them. You know, Plenty of Fish, for example, has economists that work for them, sifting through their data, working on their algorithms. You know, the way that people match on these services is determined by the data tools that economists use. But we have, now we're in the era of big data, so we know things like how people on Facebook behave. Like, so for example, one of the biggest predictors about whether or not people are going to change their Facebook status to an in a relationship is that they increase the number of likes and comments on each other's posts. We can get that out of the data.
Really?
Yeah. And there's actually some interesting data that comes out of breakups. Thanks to things like Facebook, we actually know, have a better sense about when people break up, because people will say, change their Facebook status, right? They'll stop being in a relationship with somebody. And now we know that people actually essentially break up two times a year. They break up 2 weeks before Christmas, and they break up the day after Valentine's Day. We didn't know that before. I mean, of course, people break up all the time, but these are really peak periods for this. We know this because we have access to this data.
Is there a hypothesis around income inequality based on your earlier thing about how we tend to be attracted to people who are like us, and you don't see the person with multiple degrees dating the person who didn't graduate from high school, as you said? Is that a part of this income inequality that we're seeing globally? Could it be?
Well, you know, I'm glad you asked this because, you know, because a lot of time when we talk about these topics, it sounds like it's very silly, people dating and stuff like that. But there are some really fundamental things that are going on here. Income inequality is definitely one of them. And, you know, we don't just have income inequality from marriage in the sense that, you know, people who have higher income are more likely to be married to people with higher income. And then they have children who have been heavily invested in and get to go to the best schools, and how that drives income inequality. But we also have marriage inequality. And so today, unlike ever before, we see this big gap in the rate of marriage among people who are rich and the people who are not, people who are in the lower socioeconomic groups. And those people just not marrying, not like they did in the past. And, you know, we're looking at less than 50% now marrying at any point in their lifetime. These things matter because we know that marriage contributes to all sorts of good things in our lives. And if only people who have high income and have good education are having access to them, then that becomes a social issue.
Yeah. It's not just about splitting the mortgage, though that's a part of it.
Yes.
It's a part of it. Marina, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Marina Adshade is an economist and the author of Dollars and Sex. She joined us from Vancouver.